Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I am your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we're going to be discussing Chinese illegal mining activities in Africa. I am joined by a very special guest, Professor Freedom Onoha. Professor Onoha is a senior lecturer at the University of Nigeria in Nsukka. He's also the coordinator of the Security, Violence, and Conflict Research Group, also based at the University of Nsukka. Professor Ono has written it. Okay, go on.
Doc.
Yeah.
Doc, please, the network is having issues. I don't know whether it's from your end or my end. Maybe I'll switch to another network. What do you think? Let me just switch to another network. I have to stand by.
Extensively on security in Nigeria. I've known Professor Onoha. I know your work on Boko Haram, but you've also written extensively on maritime security, not only in Nigeria, Niger Delta issues, Gulf of Guinea, Gulf of Aden, and terrorism and broadly counterterrorism. So we're very grateful to have you join us today, and I look forward to our conversation.
Thank you so very much, Mike. And let me first apologize that we have struggled over the last month to get this meeting. I thank God that finally we are meeting and we're going to have a robust conversation. I do hope for that.
I'm so glad to hear that. So in the last couple of years, I think over a decade, or let's just say in the last 20 years, we've seen the growing Chinese presence in the continent. This presence is seen to some extent in terms of positively in terms of infrastructural development, but also we're also seeing some adverse impacts in terms of like illegal mining in places like DRC Congo, Zimbabwe, and Nigeria, for instance, and Ghana, for instance. So how do you see this issue? How does China balances this in terms of, what is China's role in Africa? How does it balance out this adverse impact? Or what is the scale? I know I'm asking, but I just want to take first to start with a broad overview of China's involvement in infrastructural development in Africa and also in illegal activities in the country, in Africa and the continent.
Okay, thank you so very much. And I'm very happy that in your preliminary statement, you indeed laid out, the broad strategic outlay of China's presence and, let me say, footprint in Africa. I think in the last two decades, and precisely you are correct, I think in the last two decades, we have seen fundamental expansion in terms of the inroads that China has made in Africa, in the aspect of infrastructural development, in the aspect of military, and this is one that is not even receiving serious attention in recent times, in the aspect of investment in the oil and gas industry, a bit of even a growth of interest in the area of maritime security. But I think more importantly, and the one that is now generating a lot of concern, is the expansion and intensification of China's presence in the mining industry. I'm talking about overall broad, you know, strategic mining industry, mining of precious minerals, you know, mining of gold. Some people are beginning to think of also the mining of rare earth minerals, which, you know, play a very critical role in the aviation industry, in the electronics industry, and even in the medical and health sector. We have seen the criticality of mineral resources to the sustenance and the buoyancy of economies of many states in Africa. And so China has really found it as a gold mine, as an opportunity for it also, you know, to invest and to benefit from it. So Chinese investment in Africa across the continent has come in two principal dimensions. We have seen, you know, genuine legal Chinese investments in the mining industry. But much as its legal footprint has grown over the years, I think we have also seen, you know, the growth and expansion of illicit activities of Chinese. And I think they are actually operating, you know, under the larger, bigger umbrella that have presented, you know, opportunities for them to enter these countries. And then we've now seen instances of illicit mining of precious minerals, of rare earth elements, as well as gold in particular. And there are several countries that has really experienced the side and the negative effects of these operations. For example, one can easily mention, you know, the dangerous activities of illegal mining of the Chinese in the northwest part of Ghana. Particularly, you may have heard what the Ghanaians call galamsey. Yeah, you know, it simply means is to gather them all and sell. Which for me, and again, having this conversation with you sounds very interesting, Michael, because you also understand something similar that is happening in our backyard in the Niger Delta, you know, what we call illegal oil bunkering or oil theft. So the artisanal refining part of it is what the local people in the Niger Delta calls bow fire, you know, which means using local wood and fire, you know, to refine and produce oil. So much as we are having this local nomenclature, you know, to understand an illicit aspect of the extraction and processing of critical resource, you know, like oil in the Niger Delta, we are already seeing such a nomenclature being used in Ghana in the form of galamsey, you know, to capture, you know, the illicit and artisanal mining of gold. And I think the clearest signboard you can always point at when you are going in that direction is to, you know, is to make reference to the conviction in 2023 of the Chinese lady called An Yuan, you know, which was given about nearly 5 years of imprisonment for her, you know, extensive engagement in illegal gold mining in Ghana. That has left, you know, have left a lot of devastation in terms of the income, in terms of the economy, and in terms of local livelihood. And I do hope in the course of our conversation, some of these issues will come up in terms of the impact of the activities. Down in Nigeria, again, we have also seen instances almost on a yearly basis. You will definitely see reports of the Economic, Financial and Crimes Commission, you know, arresting several Chinese nationals who have been involved in illegal gold mining, particularly in the northwest part of the country. But a bit of them also have been reported about them operating again in the northwest part of the country. Of course, you know, that has been a hotbed of banditry, organized crime, terrorism, kidnapping, and stuff like that, which also implicates the potentials of the presence of these illicit operators are complicating the entire security and strategic landscape. And then if you go down Congo, that has never known peace since the 1960s, which is quite worrisome. As an African, we should be really concerned about what's happening in Congo. There's been evidence of, you know, illicit gold mining and illicit mining of other minerals by the Chinese that have contributed, you know, to the instability and insecurity that has persisted in DR Congo. You can also mention Zambia. So I think as much as they have penetrated Africa in their large numbers with their investment as well, I think they've come under that bridge, you know, also to engage in illicit mining of resources, which have a whole lot of negative impacts on the economies and the livelihood of the affected communities, which is something also we can look at. But just to give you this broad strategic outlay, I think this is the way and manner those of us who are very concerned about the activities of these transnational criminal actors have tended to understand what is happening, particularly in terms of the complicity and involvement of the Chinese.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. And you mentioned the complicity of the Chinese. But I think, again, when people look at it in terms of the extractive nature of the continent, how Easterners or foreigners have been extracting that continent. If you go back to colonial times and even pre-colonial, look at the Europeans first and then look at, you know, the other actors like Chinese coming in. People always talk, when they talk about the complicity of the locals. Because we can talk about this in two layers. So you can talk about the formal level in terms of the state and talk about in terms of elements, non-state elements, criminal elements. So I think let's start off from, I read your piece with, I think, with Yeole, and you were talking how the laxity in the immigration system in Nigeria, for instance, that allows the Chinese people to come, maybe tourist visa, and then, you know, these people then go on to work and do this thing. How this complicity, is it from the state not having capacity to monitor, or is there some criminal element? Is the state benefiting from it? Let's start from that state level.
Yes, and thank you, Doc. I think you also captured it very clearly in terms of the permissive environment that then enables or fosters this kind of illicit activity. For me, I think we can look at it from three layered perspective, you know, that gives rise to this kind of illicit activities. First is at the level of the complicity of the state itself. And when I'm talking about the complicity of the state itself, I'm talking about the extent to which some persons who are very powerful and influential, that has really connections and place in the anatomy of the state where these Chinese are operating, are actually benefiting from those illicit activities. At that level, it becomes very, very difficult for government officials to now stamp out or to tackle this kind of illicit activities. And then I'm going to speak around in the context of that Nigerian experience. The second level we see this complicity is at the level in which the state institutions are completely weak. And they are weak not just because they don't have the structures or the personnel that are there. They are only weak to the extent that the influence of bribery and corruption have rendered them ineffective and irrelevant, you know, in terms of performing the responsibilities that those institutions and personnel are expected to do. And let me become much more concrete and exemplary in this form. Now, if you are to enter another country, there's different levels of visas that can be given to you. And all the kinds of visas that are given to you are usually activity bound and time bound. You know, when I mean the activity bound, for example, Doc, you can actually enter the United Kingdom as a student. So you've entered the United Kingdom with a student visa, something like that. Mm-hmm. So in terms of activity bound, it suggests that you're a student. And a student, as we know, in terms of the activities, is one who goes to school to learn. Secondly, is that there is no learning process in the formal structure that doesn't have an end. So you cannot say you are a student and you're going to stay in the UK for two decades. That is not done anywhere. The UK system understands, you know, the layered process of their school. You do 5 years, maybe, for example, in Nigeria, or 6 years primary school, and then 4 years or 5 years, depending on the program, those graduate program, and then go ahead to do your PhD. Depending on the one they are giving you, they actually know what the visa allows. So the visa might say it's 4 years, the visa may say it's 2 years, which means that no matter how legal, no matter how lawful you are in the UK, after 2 years or close to 2 years, you should be ready to go. That's the truth about it. Yeah. Now, if they give you investment visa, it's the same thing. They give you a business visa. It's tied to a particular kind of business which you have already front-loaded to the state institutions to say, this is what I want to come and do in your country. This is the kind of things I'm going to do when I come in. Possibly this is where I'm going to set my companies and stuff like that, even in the formal process of repatriating profits. These things are clearly laid out. So the state institutions, the state officials, then know that, yes, Dr. Mike is coming to do business. Then they look at the validity of all that you have applied, and then they're going to give you a corresponding visa. that will now say, mm-hmm. okay, come and invest. We have done our background checks. So we're going to give you a 10-year visa, right? And so that on mm-hmm. the expiration of that, you can come for renewal. This is where the state becomes very critical, you know, in regulating some of these activities. But what we have seen in some cases, at least as the media have also shown, is that some of these Chinese would then come in under the name of tourist visa, right? Or can just come under the name of any former kind of entrant, if which the Nigerian government permits that. Now, in the case of tourist visa, usually 6 months, or maybe slightly above that. Now, you see the person staying beyond that 6 months. Now, that is in itself is a violation of the law. But it becomes much more complicated, if not criminal, when person has come on as a tourist and you've now found a person involved in a business activity. These are two different things. First, he's involved in business activity. That is already violating the terms of which the person has entered the country. Second, he's involved in a business activity in an illegal way. Then that is another level, you know, of the violation of the law. And I think this is really where the state comes in. We have seen cases where, and I think it's because of the laxity or the lethargy of the Nigerian state generally, everything about the Nigerian state in particular. So you see where these people have come in, being given visa of 6 months or 1 year, depending on whatever was given to them initially. And then we found it difficult, you know, to track these persons in terms of saying, okay, with all kinds of electronic platforms now, maybe the phone number the person used when he came in, you should at least, as a state that is functional, maybe send an SMS to say, look, in the next four or five weeks, your visa is expiring. Mm-hmm. So that serves as a reminder. So he wouldn't have said that he didn't remember that his visa has just expired, that he's enjoying your country mm-hmm. because of his hospitality, you know. So with this kind of system, it becomes easier for the state to then monitor the particular set of individuals have entered the country. But beyond then using the visa also, there are different layers of state security institutions that should play a key role, you know, in terms of having effective grasp of how these immigrants are operating in the country. We have the DSS, we have the EFCC, we have the Nigerian police that have every right to even ask you, let me see, you know, your legal permits, why you are in this country, if you have any reasonable conditions to suspect you. So this is part of where we are having the problem. So we don't have a follow-up mechanisms, you know, to first track the stays of these persons, send a reminder towards the terminal stage days of their stay, but more importantly, you know, follow on through a robust monitoring and tracking mechanisms to find out where they are, what they are doing, and when they're supposed to leave the country, so that if they fail to do so, then at least we can then arrest them and prosecute them. So I think this is where the weakness of the state at that level comes in. Then the last part of where we talk about the complicity is where you talk about, you know, given the nature of the local actors, given the nature of the local actors, you know, where you see, even if you call them local politicians or local influential persons, are complicit, you know, in the extractive industry, where they see that the Nigerian state is weak or non-existent in terms of presence of law enforcement officials, have also collaborated with some of these Chinese in these local communities, you know, to give them that passage way to exploit these mineral resources.
Let me follow up on that. That ties well into my next question. So we've seen, for instance, like DRC Congo, and then you see around DRC Congo to Rwanda to Uganda, around the Horn of Africa, you've seen where the Chinese, where illegal mining always operates, there's always as a place where there's always conflict, where you have rebels in DRC Congo, and there's been accusation of Chinese illegal miners funding these rebels. And also in your paper, somewhere in the Northwest, for instance, in Northwest Nigeria, where we see a lot of kidnapping and armed bandits, we've seen that as well. So does it go hand in hand? Why is it that illegal mining always go hand in hand with places where there are rebels, where there are armed bandits? I think the question is, are they causing that conflict? Are they funding, or are they just coming into that conflict and using the opportunity, or are they the source of that conflict? How did they manipulate that conflict to their own advantage?
Yeah, again, in all sense of honesty, I think in some contexts you have to see it as the endless chicken and the egg debate, which is whether it was the outbreak of conflict that attracted them to benefit from there, or it is actually their entrance that then complicates the conflict environment. I think it, sometimes it becomes a very big question to answer, unless you come down to the very macro level of the history of that conflict and the particular context you are referring to, then that's when you discover which one, the direction of the effect. But I think you're absolutely correct in terms of the intricate relationship, between the existence of criminal activities like, whether it's transnational organized crime or whether it's organized crime, it's nature, and then insecurity and conflict. That nexus have a long-standing history. It did not start with illicit mining, but I think in the context of illicit mining of resources in Africa, we have seen it, foster and flourish. In the context of the Northeast, for example, in the Northwest, for example, I think that the entrance of the illegal miners further complicated the crisis, because the reason is very simple. In the context of conflict situation, whether is the case is that the state is complicit or weak that led to the conflict, or whether the conflict is there and the state has not the capacity, to rein in the warring parties. We have always seen a situation whereby organized criminal groups tend to benefit from chaos. In the Northwest, for example, people never knew that the magnitude of illegal mining was going on in that part of the country until we now saw, heightened incident of banditry, where cases communities are sacked completely, and then where the military will be forced to go in, to bring in some semblance of order, and where the military and other state security forces have failed completely, to dominate the conflict theater. What has come out very clearly is that those who benefit in such criminal activities do not want a sense of stability and security, because, when you have stability and security, then the presence and the capacity of the state is firm and far-flung. So the state can definitely act precisely in that environment. But when you have, serious cases of instability and insecurity, which in itself, I'm sure you know, which in itself is an indication that the state itself is very weak. And so where you have that kind of situation, the tendency is for organized crime and transnational criminal activities to, to flourish and foster. That has played out in the Northwest. There are a lot of evidence to suggest that even bandits themselves profit from the illegal mining going on in some places like banditry. Two, there are evidence also suggests that state officials, including politicians, are benefiting from the illegal mining of gold in the Northwest part of the country, including Zamfara. There is also some evidence to show that some foreign nationals are also benefiting from illegal mining of gold. I'm very specific around Zamfara state. Then two critical things that people have usually not asked themselves the question, and I always pose it when I have opportunity to discuss this. The worth of gold in the international market. Nobody's asking question, how are these gold being refined? Are they refining it here, or are they taking it outside? Those are two critical intelligence questions to ask. And I think the easiest things are being refined outside, because we cannot really easily see, well-standard factories or companies where these golds are being properly refined and then molded into the gold bar and then exported to the international market. This gives you, a clearer vision, even though it is clouded in secrecy. But then from an intellectual and from an intelligent point of view, it gives you a complete clear picture that there is an external dimension to the crisis and the conflict we are having in the Northwest. Because those who benefit from this illicit transportation and transfer of these stolen gold in the international market will be happy for at least one important reason. Very likely, all precious minerals that are extracted in conflict environment are far cheaper than the actual market price. So the result, therefore, is that one way or the other, these profiteers and beneficiaries from these, the complex local and transnational networks that, sustains illegal mining will be definitely ensuring the perpetuity and the persistence of insecurity, because it's under that context of chaos that their trade flourishes and thrives. And that is where they have the highest prospect of making profit. And so that is why you now see that it has become almost difficult for the Nigerian state in the context of the Northwest, you know, to end the banditry and, more importantly, to end the illegal mining. Because the political economy that sustains this illicit activity is not being addressed. Nobody's asking questions about that. We're only asking questions about the criminal manifestation in terms of killing of innocent persons and displacement of women and children. That's the kind of attention. I'm sure I can bet you this. If you listen to any kind of local or international news and analysis, this is the kind of thing they're mentioning. 30,000 persons killed. Who is asking question, you know, about the political economy of interest that underpin and sustain this kind of criminal violence, you know, that benefits other persons? And
I was going to come to the because obviously there has to be some level of cooperation, illegal cooperation between the state or some powerful people, because to mine gold or mine such things, it requires some heavy equipment and stuff like that. But I guess what I was going to ask is this. What is the impact of this mining on the environment? Because one of my... Go on.
Yeah, thank you so very much. I think, well, I don't know. Mike, you know, we are friends, and I want to make this in a lot relaxed and conversational, and I do hope I'm not breaching any professional media.
No, you're not.
We are having. I wanted to ask whether you're an environmentalist, that you are more interested in the impact of,
no,
the,
I'm
of
not.
The environment.
I think
that really, as a political economist, maybe I'm sure you don't know my PhD is in political economy. I'm sure you suspect I'm in security, right?
Well, I saw something you did on I was looking at it. You did something on water. You actually did something on climate. You did something for your master's, I think, or something that they shouted that. So, you know, that's why I'm asking that question, to be honest.
Okay, that's fantastic. Okay, let me be a much more broad and liberal in my response. I think that if you pay particular attention in terms of the dynamics, the scope, and intensity of the operation of illegal mining in Africa, you can isolate at least five levels of impact in the society. For me, you know, as a scholar in criminal violence and organized crime, I think you can isolate at least five major levels of impact. First, we look at the economic dimension. We can look at the environmental dimension that is of interest to you. We can look at the socioeconomic or social dimension of it. We can look at the security dimension of it. And more importantly, which you don't see people bring in or bring on the table when discussions are going on, you can look at the strategic impact. And I will just try to throw, let me just throw a bit of some lights on some of these areas and then tell you some of the streams that are involved. Let's look at, first, let's look at the economic impact generally. I think that the first thing we have seen across the places where illegal mining have operated is that we have seen increasing accumulation by dispossession. Let me talk from a political economy point of view. I think we have seen increasing accumulation by dispossession. And this accumulation that leads to dispossession appears in two interrelated forms. Then you need to wear in your very clear, powerful lenses to, you know, to be able to separate them, but they're interrelated. In terms of the economy, the whole dynamics of accumulation by dispossession, because these foreigners, in particular the Chinese, those guys that are coming in to invest illegally in mining resources, they come with a capital. You know, they come with a capital that is usually higher in terms of, you know, purchasing power, if you want to put it that way, higher than the ones the locals are doing. The result, therefore, is that from a power parity, from, you know, a money financial power parity, they have come into a competition with the locals. The result is that they dispossess the locals, they submerge the locals, and the locals who are involved in illegal mining are now forced to work under the rubrics of the illegal mining networks created by the Chinese. So we are talking about criminality, but we are talking about the layers of criminality. So the first thing we have seen is that they tend to dispossess the local people who may have been the original initiators of this illegal mining process, of which the state may have neglected and overlooked it because the level and the scope of activities is very low. So you have now seen that level of dispossession. Excuse me. The second level of dispossession is dispossession that has to do with assets and livelihood assets. Now, when they come into illegal mining, they look out for areas that are rich for these resources. Sometimes, as we have seen in cases like in Ghana, some of these areas that are rich in resources are also areas that are very rich in terms of agricultural activities. Yeah. And in most cases, this is where rural women are farming. And this is what implicates gender in the whole discourses around illegal mining. And you see, there's quite a universe of issues around this that are not being discussed currently. And so now this is where the local people depend on farming, particularly women. Now, you now see that the more and more they expand their reach in this illegal mining, the more they dispossess these people of their land, either forcefully or, of course, by the impact of destroying and excavating the lands. People's farming, farmlands are being destroyed and dispossessed from them. Those of them who are not prepared to be part and parcel of the illegal mining process, then are dispossessed. That's why I talked about dispossession, accumulation by dispossession. So they are now dispossessed, but the legal Chinese then accumulate resources and money from this process. These are the two critical directions you see it immediately at that macro level of, you know, community economy. And it's also connected to the economy of the state. Now, imagine the quantity of land originally devoted to planting and processing of cocoa, you know, which is known for making chocolate, that has been devastated by illegal mining in Ghana. Look, that has serious implications for the state, not only for the local livelihood, but for the economic base of the state, where you find out that a whole lot of internally generated revenue comes into the coffers of Ghanaian government from processing cocoa. Which, you know, I think is Ghana and Ivory Coast. I don't know which one is number one or number two.
I think Ivory Coast. I think Ivory Coast is the highest.
Yeah. The highest. Then maybe followed then by, of course, then followed by Ghana. Then you can begin to quantify per every acre of land devoted for planting and raising cocoa that has been destroyed or have made, you know, unfarmable as a result of illegal gold mining. Then you can begin to appreciate that, particularly for a serious country, that could then be quantified. Then let me enter the place where the terrain you are so much interested in, the environment. You know,
I need to correct you, but let you finish. But go ahead, anyways.
Okay, so let's look at the level of the environment. Again, I think there are three broad interrelated spectrums of destruction of the environment that illegal mining brings into play. Let's start with the first one, you know, which is the one that they have to dig up the earth to discover the precious, the mineral. Let us not talk about gold, because it's illegal mining and it can take in different forms. So whether they are looking for tantalum or cobalt, or they are looking for gold, whichever one they are looking for, it goes with excavating the earth. And because it's illegal, there is no remedial measure put in place that after excavating these grounds, then you have to, you know, do a remedial measure that say, for example, bring them back, you know, the earth back, level the places so that in tomorrow you will not have ditches that will contain water, or you will not make it difficult for people to construct land in those places. If you have a look at pictures of sites where these illegal mining are going on, you just see something like a mountain, a valley, a mountain, a valley, a mountain, a completely undulating landscape as a result of random and indiscriminate, you know, excavation of the earth. That's the first thing you see. You know, when we discuss these issues of climate change, there's a lot of things that is going on, people are not paying attention. These illegal mining operations itself contribute to deforestation, because again, if the gold is sitting on top of a banana tree, or is sitting on top of a iroko tree or a mango tree, or African star apple tree, any kind of tree whatsoever. I don't want to go medicinal. Remember, I don't want to go medicinal. But some of these plants we are talking about that are being destroyed because we are excavating the earth surface are key to the local traditional medicinal livelihoods of these communities, right? But just let's use the language that the West likes so much, deforestation. Now, these activities are now causing serious deforestation. And nobody's asking questions the implications of this deforestation in terms of contribution to climate change, greenhouse gases, and stuff like that. Climate change and greenhouse gases like that. That's a question me and you can ask and get the mathematics to do the analysis for us and break it down in quantitative terms. Nobody's asking question about that. Then let me give you the third level, which is where when you made mention of the truck, heavy trucks and things they bring in, our engineer. So the third level is what we're now talking. We're talking about people using heavy trucks. We're talking about people using heavy trucks, right, to move from towns, you may call it town or you want to call it urban area, to move from town or any urban area to some of these rural communities where this artisanal mining and refining is going on, right? And they go excavate the much they want to excavate. On coming out, then they get one or two state security official, a policeman, a gendarme, or whoever the person is. And then they say, look, no, it's pieces of what we want to use in our factory. It's just stones and the rest of them. Because, again, the policeman doesn't even know that that pieces of stone, he's looking at it, that there are a lot of precious mineral inside it. He gives the person, you know, something equivalent to $30. The person is happy. This is about 60% of his salary was just given to him in a day. He's, in fact, even looking forward to going to the market from there. Maybe to buy one local chicken so that his family will be happy they ate something precious that evening. So everything rides on poverty, and I think I'm going to reflect on that in future. So they give the person the money. The person is happy. The person waves him on to continue his destination. And then at the higher level, which we have also discussed, there are some state officials who are also benefiting from all this, you know, the complex of this illicit activity, who doesn't give a damn the quantity that is being extracted and exploited. On a daily basis, heavy trucks are moving on these rural communities and rural roads that are connecting the sites of illegal mining and then the towns of where they have been exported. One of the things we have seen clearly everywhere, if you go to Jos, where some of this has happened, or in Zamfara, you see that those unpaved local roads have been devastated, right? There's a whole lot of potholes, there's a whole lot of scrater. And the only way people go to those communities is to use some rickety bus. Now, that in itself has destroyed the road of the local community. The government is not there to be seen, right? And now, the only job that this kind of criminal activity creates is that you then see some rickety, poverty-stricken youths, two or three of them, manage to get shovel from somewhere, and then stand by those potholes or those craters to filling it up and then asking people to give them money. That's the kind of poverty, you know, illicit exploitation of resources creates. And that's the kind of job it creates in local communities. As funny as it is, that is the tragic dimension of the environmental implications of these activities, you know. Then we're not talking about the loss of revenue, which I've mentioned. Now let's talk about the security dimension. I just hinted to that, alluded to that. Recall that this is an illicit activity. The only way it can thrive and flourish, it can only thrive either on violence or it thrives on bribery and corruption. And in most cases, it is even cheaper for them to thrive on bribery and corruption than on violence. Because sometimes when it thrives on violence, it inadvertently attracts the attention of state security forces, where the state itself had ordinarily ignored that environment. So when it thrives on violence, it can force the state now to act. So in most cases, we have seen it thrive on corruption and bribery. That in itself inadvertently weakens the state institution over time, you know, and then begins to corrode, you know, public trust and confidence in those institutions. For example, we have seen communities that have been complaining about activities of foreign companies. And the more they complain, the more they see that they are powerless. The result, therefore, is that their powerlessness, they translate it to, you know, a decline in faith in state institutions. They believe they talk to the state authorities. They believe they've talked to the representatives of the state. They can see that these representatives of the state are actually not acting on their complaints. So the next thing is for them to give up on state institutions. Why are they giving up? Because the state cannot act. Why is that not acting? Because the state institution has been compromised through bribery. How was it compromised through bribery? Because of the activities of illegal mining and other transnational organized criminal activities. That in itself, that is the connection. So you now see that because it thrives on corruption, it weakens the state institution and even the capacity of the state to provide security. Security, not in the hard sense of kinetic state security. I'm talking about security for the ordinary man, which is human security. Mm-hmm. Preserve my road so that I can actually go to local communities, and do my business without much hassles. Preserve my farm and stuff like that. That is where the problem comes in. Then the last one I think I have to mention is the whole discourse about how it tends to exacerbate strategic fragility of states. In states where we have seen conflict go on, the more you have this entrance of foreigners, the more the strategic fragility of the state is deepened. The reason is very simple. Some of these actors tend to then side with the parties that are fighting the state. So the kind of resources and money they give tends to exacerbate the fragility of the state, then making it almost difficult for you to think of the day or the year or the month that peace will return to such a conflict-torn environment. Look at Congo, for example. Mike, I'm sure me and you started yelling of Congo while we are in primary school. And now we are still using that same country as a reference point to discuss about, you know, long-term conflicts, state fragility and stuff like that. These are some of the things that made it extremely difficult for Congo to stand on its feet, because external interests, particularly the ones that come in the form of vested interest in the political economy of extraction of resources, have tended to make it difficult for the state, you know, to regain its strength. And so it tends to exacerbate and perpetuate state fragility. Look at what is
happening in the West.
I think it's going to be extremely difficult for the Nigerian state, you know, this problem. So you can go ahead, please.
I was going to talk about Congo, because I in one of our episodes, the former national speaker on the Congo in Congo, and she's a current MP, and she came on one of the podcasts, and we talked about these issues of extracting cobalt and stuff like that, and then
and
Kodam and all of that. And surprisingly, once we talk about climate change, the irony is once we're looking to say, oh, we're going green now, the minerals we need, the rare earth minerals we need, are also largely in Africa, in Congo, for instance. And then again, we see how it's inspired this geopolitical competition, where China, again, has like 20 years head start in that place. China controls nearly 80% of, you know, the mining there. But in that case, not all is illegal. There's a place where they've gone, and the MP was telling me how I just wanted to talk about agency here, where they feel like, you know, the US, they feel like, oh, we need to come into this game now. We need to come into the mining of these resources now. China is going, and then it might create another geopolitical competition for the resources and become another problem. But before you respond to that, I was going to correct the impression you got. About, I wasn't just so much particular about the environment, because I've got one master student that is looking at how in a particular area, community in Congo, how the activities of the mining has, and they're just less than a million, and it's you know, a lot of people have been dispossessed from their land in that place. So I'm glad you mentioned the broad, wide implication of this mining stuff. I guess my question is, what is the role of the state? What is the agency? How are they regulating it? In Nigeria, for instance, there's so much focus on oil and less focus on... And you mentioned something in the article that the resources we have, all these mineral resources, gives about, if I'm not mistaken, say about $70 billion, something in that figure. So what is the state doing in regulating? What are the existing laws that are regulating this? How's the state responding to it?
Yeah, okay. For solid minerals, as you know, we kept our crude oil is a precious thing for us. It's our blood. So everything about that crude oil, Ministry of Petroleum and stuff like that comes, you know, takes charge of that.
Yes.
Other ones, we call it solid minerals. So it's the Ministry of Mines, you know, and it's responsible for that. I've not looked at the real, you know, legal term by term prescriptions of how these are going to be played out. But all mineral resources belongs to the Nigerian state. That, there's no doubt about that. Now, the Ministry of Mines is supposed to be overseeing, you know, the issuance of licenses to mine a particular kind of mineral, precious mineral, normal minerals, rare earth elements, and stuff like that. Beyond that, also, they also need to have the ministry, you know, to oversee, you know, the standard. Usually these things work, you know, in an interministerial format, because again, they are expected also to turn in the environmental impact assessment. Yes, that I nearly missed that. Every company operating in that direction is expected to first give the state, you know, an idea of the environmental impact assessment of what the activities look like and how they hope to mitigate those environmental impacts. So yeah, this is again where the Ministry of Environment interfaces with the Ministry of Mines, because this have impact on the environment. Now the question is, after giving the question is, who is even giving the license? That's the point. Very few of these companies are operating in Nigeria with license. I remember that even the one that was operating in license, the Ritual, the one they call the Ritual Mining Company, was last year suspended by Nigerian government for engaging in illegal mining of tantalite. I think they were not giving license to mine tantalite. I think something else we are giving, you know, is a solid mineral, but it was not tantalite. But then you can see how these guys diversify their criminal tendency. So they've left what they were given and then engage in license they were given to engage in other mining activities. And I think it's kudos to the ministry that has worked. I think they work with the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission to get that resolved. Now, this is where a whole lot of, you know, interministerial umbrella is needed, you know, to serve like a 24/7, you know, real-time situation awareness of what is happening in that sector. Honestly speaking, I don't want to say claim that I'm an expert in the mining ministry, but I think that ministry has really not been up and doing as it should be, particularly, you know, acting beyond issuing licenses to actually developing a robust mechanism for real-time
monitoring
of these persons, not just in sites, not just in the sites allocated to them, but in the entire value chain of what are they doing. If he says you must process those things in Nigeria, are they processing it in Nigeria? Again, if they're not processing it in Nigeria, I'm sure you know it's a violation of the act or the provisions or the terms of their contract. So we need to do that. And this is where a whole lot of things need to come in. You know, when they're talking about the state, first need to strengthen its capacity to issue valid license, must strengthen the capacity to have a monitoring mechanism to oversee the activities of these, you know, foreign companies, to be sure that their activities are in line and in tandem with the provisions of their contract. The state also supposed to have a mechanism of getting feedbacks from the community in relation with the activities of these mining companies to be able to now identify clearly some of the impacts of these activities that may not have genuinely, may not have been genuinely captured on the environmental impact assessment. Nobody knows it all, right? We can do an environmental impact assessment before you start an activity, and then all of a sudden you now start noticing that impact.
Yes,
and so in your updated report, that could be captured. And in most cases, when you don't have the alternative voice raise this issue, they will continue giving the state the dead Omori bond or old report. Just, you know, the way we do this in this university. You remove the cover page and put a cover page and change one or two things. And again, where corruption comes in, then with an envelope accompanying the report, somebody thinks it's good. And you know, there's no need. I'm not talking about Nigeria, but this is how it happened in most of African states. So the capacity, you know, to monitor is very critical. It should be more important even than the capacity to issue license, because you can issue license and then you've already opened your environment for destruction, right? So I think that is why it is important. And then finally, I'm trying to make sure there is a loop, you know, there is an oversight and monitoring loop that connects the ministries with the critical security agencies that are very relevant to some of these. For example, the EFCC, and they are doing well. You know, I must have to commend them, even if the few ones they are unearthing their illegal activities. It does give us hope that if we strengthen more of these illicit activities, I think that there must have to be a clear nexus. I'm not a fan of creating committees. You know, in this country, once anything happens, they say create a special tax force, create a committee to do this, create an international committee. Yeah. I'm really not a fan of proliferation of committees and yeah. commissions.
As I've looked at the political economy. I was going to write actually on that. Political economy of setting up commissions and committees. Yeah. I think there's a political economy to it. You might be very, very, very. But I was going to say something because, you know, this topic, like you rightly mentioned, is quite broad. The implications, the direct implications, the indirect implications is so wide. It's unbelievable. But if you're going to look at, if you take a broad overlook, let me ask the last question and give you the opportunity to take look at the broad overlook and say, okay, how do we solve this issue? How do we bring a light to the relationship between illegal mining and insecurity and funding of terrorist groups and then even kidnapping? Because we're not, like Riley mentioned, we're not focusing attention on that. How do we beam light on that? How do we... and you also mentioned something about there's legal and illegal, and even illegal, that interface is not even clear. Some people come legally and then they how do we... You started mentioning ways, but I wanted to just conclude by expanding on that and giving very specific, you know, ways to address the issues.
Yeah, I'm sure if you reflect on our conversation in the last maybe 45 to 15 minutes time, you then discover that we are dealing with one subject matter, but it is multifaceted and it is complex. And then that presupposes that any effective and efficacious response will definitely has to be multifaceted and it has to be multi-layered. But more importantly, it has to be interlinked, because then that is the only way. If they act in silos, these responses, if they operate in silos, they cannot converge to neutralize the COG, the center of gravity of these criminal activities. I think that the different levels of interventions are needed to begin to neutralize these activities. Let's start with where me and you have always been arguing, the political. You know, all these things boils down to the political. If the political capacity of the leaders, you know, to rein in these criminals are very low, we will stay in this station every day, 24/7, discussing this matter, and it will not happen. Given the direction and the dimension of the crisis, we have seen that external actors are involved. So if external actors are involved, there are two ways to do it. It's to look at the immigration and the entrance dimension to it. So for the lawful immigration, which is people who come in with their visas, the lawful visas and extraction, then government need to tighten, you know, control. They have to be a system. Just like, I think this is how it is, just that people don't want to do their job because of the benefits they are getting. There need to be like a dashboard, you know, when you see the pilot fly, in front of them are all kinds of lights, screens, buttons, and stuff like that. It gives them real-time situational awareness of the weather, the height, the speed of the aircraft, and the direction they are going. You need this kind of, you know, robust dashboard. Electronic dashboard in front of our state actors that will say, Michael Wampa, Professor Fido Monoha, Jonathan Jang, all kinds of names. He lists them. He lists their nationality. He lists when their visas are expiring. We have it. You program it. Then you have a clear sense of who is in the country, when is he supposed to leave. You can set a reminder. I'm sure you remember in the course of our conversation, you just intended me to say, you set a reminder. The reminder told you that we're going to have this conversation in 20 minutes. It's very simple as that, because you have so many things you are doing. You can configure a system. It gives you a reminder that, look, so visas are already expiring. So, and we are doing it. These days, I'm like, you're not in Nigeria. These days, the vehicle inspection, now my memory is failing me. The Federal Road Safety Corps, I think, that is involved in your driver license and your plate number, right? Now, they've done the right thing. Now they send you, before your car paper expires, they send you a reminder, which in itself is a valid evidence to be tendered in law. You couldn't say you forgot. They said it's programmed that a reminder tells you that your license is expiring in the next 2 weeks. So you go and renew it. You don't need to wait for it to expire. You can go and renew it. So we can.
Go ahead.
I'm saying that we have a lot of eggheads. We have very tech-savvy youths, guys across the length and breadth of this country that are graduating from our universities that we can easily employ. You know, those guys leverage on this latest technological, even artificial intelligence, you know, to develop a system where you monitor these people so that the states can then begin to enforce, you know, the provisions of those contracts. That is very important. Therefore, the unlawful side of it that talks about people entering the country illegally. I don't think these Chinese enter from where me and you move to Mali, Niger, Congo. They will never try that risk. I'm sure you understand what I mean. So, but if you say the porous borders, we always talk about the porous borders. They don't follow there, but there are other Africans who play a key part in enabling this criminal exploitation. So we need also to strengthen our border. Is that any connected to illicit mining? Because again, people have been saying that some of these illegal gold they mine in Nigeria go as far as, you know, to the Middle East, go as far as being refined in Dubai and being sold in Dubai. I don't have evidence to that, but that's what people are alluding to. So the question, therefore, is that if you must tighten the noose around the porosities of our border, land, air, and sea, then you would have prevented people from coming in and also prevented people from taking out some of these products. The next one is that the mechanism to track work permits must go hand in hand with the mechanism for visa issuance. That must be connected. So the visa is different, the work permit is different, but we need to connect that so that we then know whoever that has a particular work permit is operating within the work permit that is given. Then I think also that I'm sure you don't really know, maybe you know, but I'm sure you have not really given a thought to the multiplier effect of the program you are having. I'm sure you've not really given a thought. I think you're doing it out of passion as an academic, you know, to raise awareness. I think this is, again, where the media comes in. We need to begin, you know, to encourage. I don't want to use the word invest because it's against the DNA of African leaders, you know, to use the word invest. I don't think they like investing on anything, actually. I'm sorry I'm using those very strong words. But we need to begin to invest on investigative journalism. You know, we need to invest more in investigative journalism. Journalists can go underground, you know, with spy cameras and so much trainings they've received in recent times to unearth not just the actors, but the networks and the dynamics. You know, the system that enables this kind of extensive pillaging of, you know, resources. And so even go as far as even implicating some of the state actors. If we invest, if indeed we want to end this problem, if we invest on investigative journalism and these guys do this journalism, bring out their evidence, their identity is hidden, but the evidence is there, we can begin to deal with this problem. So maybe I will first use the word invest. Let's hope that we have political leaders that know the value of investment. We can invest on investigative journalism as a nation, as a state, you know, to begin to unearth the dynamics, the actors, the interests, and the networks that sustain this kind of criminality at a very large scale and in a devastating form for the African society, economy, and people. Then I think the next point is also beyond investigative journalism. I think also we need to begin to raise, you know, community consciousness about the impact of this illegal mining. Local communities need to know that beyond the short-term benefit of the small money they are getting, once these guys, you know, completely sucks up these resources, they will leave. Nobody's going to level the ditches for them. Nobody's going to, that costs the state more to be able to do that. And so we need to begin to let them know that, you know, it's just beyond what they think about their daily bread that they get from some of this artisanal mining. You know, to begin to raise their consciousness, identifying persons of influence in the community, working with youth, working with the elderly, you know, to begin to create, you know, a mass of conscious resistance. And that, let me put it that way. I think, you know, begin to generate that consciousness that swells up their level of resistance against this kind of illicit activity. And also to encourage them never to give up hope. Because I've also seen cases where, and this is happening in the state where I am based right now, I've also seen cases where local communities have protested seriously against the loud noise that comes with an extractive process that is going on underground. And the fact that that is affecting their health, and I am sure of what I'm saying, because it's coming from a very fleshy person in the community. And they petitioned the state government. But like me and you have said before, Mike, you know, the political economy of it makes it a lot difficult beyond, you know, local community consciousness and awareness raising. So some of them who are in the corridors of government are more interested in the money they are making. And it gets worse when they are not even from the community. So the person is from the other community, doesn't even know what they are talking. His account is growing fatter and fatter. But I think we need also, you know, to invest in raising community consciousness and sensitization about the narrator's impact of this in terms of the short term, the medium term, and the long term, even the unforeseen consequences that will come in the near future. For example, I mentioned that the way they deforestate the environment, we are losing some of our plants that has medicinal value. Maybe by the time we will discover that the particular tree that will solve HIV/AIDS is in their local community, hey, people will shout, you may have remaining only one or two trees. And so illicit miners have destroyed them. I think we need to begin to bring this to the consciousness of our people through a concerted government-civil society collaboration. And then finally, I think we need to also to invest in monitoring technology. You know, and this is again where the state comes in. I think these things have been done everywhere. You can buy a few drones and then use these drones, you know, to monitor some of these ones you've given the license to operate. You are the state. So nobody will say you don't have powers to occasionally buzz in with your drone to be sure that even the mining is taking place only within the radius of the acres of land given to you to do that. Mm-hmm. And that is also something very important. I think the Nigerian state and indeed every African state we may need to begin to think of. So invest on technologies, satellite technologies, monitoring technologies like UAVs, that give them real-time awareness of the activities going on in their territory. In that way, they will monitor those ones that are legal, and at the same time, they monitor those ones that are illegal. I think if we do this, it may not be all, but I think in that way, we may begin to get a handle of the real situation and then begin to roll back the impact of illegal mining on African economies, peoples, and society.
Prof, I think we would this all of this that we'll write a PhD thesis on it. All you said that we feel a PhD thesis.
Yeah. Yeah, that could be an interesting. Can you have an interesting thing? Those of you who are staying in the client that are all things are made perfect for you, you can always get the recording and give one of your PhD students. I've done something like this in the past. I gave one of my master students, and so transcribe this, add some level of flesh to it, find the theoretical framework, and then we'll publish it. So if you do it,
one of my students is she's I think she's from Kenya. She's doing a master's, so she's looking at Chinese extracted in Congo, and I is dispossessing. So I've been encouraging her to take it up as a PhD. But what I'm trying to say is, what I'm trying to say is, if you provided very extensive, in this very short amount of space and time, it's very extensive insight and into the wide, you know, you think it's just one level, different layers of how this thing affects not just the environment, the social impact, the political impact, the economic impact, and then also looking at how we can deal with it at different levels, the state level. And I'm happy you mentioned investigative journalism and the community side, because I remember I interviewed Showore, and once I said to him that, you know, I don't think and I said it to him, I don't think I had a business going to contest for presidency, because he was doing well when they started off as investigative journalists. And Nigerians before wouldn't have access to the budget. And his work in there, you know, people, they started showing the budget, you know, he was very novel for that to happen. So I think the investigative journalists, the community consciousness, which I think is education. We need to educate our people. It plays a very, very big role. That, Prof, we are very, very grateful. I know you're not feeling very well, your voice, but we thank you for granting us the time. And we'll keep you posted. And hopefully we bring you back again and see if, you know, if progress has been made, if some of this remedy that you mentioned, if they will take it on board. We might bring it up in the future to come and talk about it. But I really appreciate your presence.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Dr. Mike Mwamba. And I pray that God continue to strengthen you and give you that wisdom to, you know, draw in some of the experts we have around to give the real genuine African perspective to some of these issues, because there are quite a lot of issues that have been impacting on us as people and as a continent. And the more we have people speak from the genuine African perspective, and I think it will help not just the Africans, but also Africans who are outside Africa to get a clearer picture of what is happening. So I thank you so much. And also, please extend my deepest regrets to your staff. I think she was chasing me more than I can even I felt the best situation, despite my health situation, is to honor this invitation, because I'm sure
she's so grateful, so she will continue.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you so much. It's an honor.
I appreciate it. I'll keep it posted, and once it's out, we share. I will be grateful if you can help us share it with your network.
No, for sure. The moment it hits my ear, I will give you the amplification that it rightly deserves.
All right. Thank you, sir. Have a great evening.
Thank you so much, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you, viewers, for another yet amazing episode discussing Chinese illegal mining in Africa. Join me to thank our guest, Professor Freedom Onoha, for providing rich discussion and conversation. I encourage you to tune in next week to another episode. For now, remain blessed, and I'll see you next week.